Good evening. Do you all know about Mahagosananda? Nobody.
You do.
Oh. Huh. Well, he was a Theravadan monk, so Zen people aren't likely to know about him, I suppose. But he was considered to be a very, very great Buddhist practitioner, I guess you could say. He was a monk. He lived in Cambodia and initiated peace walks during the terrible crisis that Cambodia went through with the Khmer Rouge and after, all the way up, I think, until last year when he was way, way up in his 90s. He, in the last 10 years or so, wasn't able anymore to speak. It wasn't clear how much of his intellectual mind was working anymore, but his presence shone. I've never been in such a presence as his. Very small, very simple monk with one bare shoulder, who sat at a meeting that there was an international meeting of teachers at Spirit Rock about 8 years ago or so. The Dalai Lama came, a bunch of monks came from Sri Lanka. It was a fascinating meeting. And Mahagosananda was there and just sat beaming in the middle of all of it. And at the end, he sat sort of apart from everyone. And if you went up to him and bowed, he would put a string around your wrist. And he must have done that for 50 people, beaming the whole time. So in the internet, of course, the word went out in a flash. He died yesterday morning, and now the whole Buddhist world is aware of it and dedicating ceremonies to his being. I was thinking when we chanted the sutra, Kogan always said, even at a death, it's a joyous thing to chant. Gate, gate, paragate. Going on, going on. So we have a couple of new faces tonight. Welcome. We should do introductions around.
I'm Darlene. I'm Andy.
I'm Hal.
I'm Dan.
Cliff.
Lauren.
Jane.
Julian. Angie. Well, Cliff, this is really nice. Cliff is an old friend from GKOG and even before. I don't know how far back it even goes. Ah, yes. Well, you're one of the stalwarts at GKOG now, so I think we all owe you a great debt of gratitude to keeping the whole thing going. Thank you. So we're studying this odd ancient document called the Ox Herding Pictures, which is a kind of metaphor. It is a metaphorical expression of kind of the stages of practice, which as Zen practicers we don't really consider to be even quite accurate. or at least we try not to think about them so much, because then it gets in the way of our actual practice of just being completely present. It's paradoxical, because it's helpful to pass our minds through these 10 so-called stages, starting with spying the real self or the true self sort of off in the bushes somewhere, and then slowly getting acquainted with it as a large beast, as a huge beast, compared to the size of the little one who finds it, and then becomes not only familiar but friendly with it, and then is able to ride on it, and then eventually to go home on it. So we've gotten to the going home part. What we call the refuges, the refuge in Buddha and Dharma and Sangha, and we take refuge during Sesshin. We often take refuge at the very end of the day. There's a beautiful song of it that we sing. I was sitting with a group in Menlo Park yesterday, and we sang the refuges at the very end of the evening. Jane introduced that to us, I think, when we began doing that. So we're familiar with going home. They call the refuges sometimes plunging into Buddha and Dharma and Sangha, plunging into the truth, into the whole catastrophe, as Dido calls it sometimes. He calls it returning to the natural order of things. Things just as they are. It's a realization, and I suppose you could call each one of these stages a realization. That as we live our life, now and then we just open our eyes to some new way of seeing and feeling and understanding. And at this point, the realization is that what we were looking for all along is where we always were and are. There isn't any way to where to go, except to go home. So it's a point of commitment to ourself, commitment to trusting ourself, in spite of really what we now begin to understand is our extremely flawed existence. That in spite of our lack of perfection, that we can trust this. And that the striving for perfection itself is a kind of splitting of what is whole and complete and fine, just the way it is. It's what I always say. There's the perfect one we want to be, and then the one that is doing the wanting. And so there are two, where there's really just one. So accepting is, in a way, the first step to meeting oneself and meeting everything else. At this point, we begin to have some kind of feeling about emptiness and the relationship of what are sometimes called the absolute and the relative, or emptiness and form. And that mysterious formula that we chant, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Absolute isn't up there somewhere. Form isn't in isolation and separation from emptiness, from absolute. It's how we practice with our zazen that these kind of awkward ideas begin to shape us, you could say, or reveal themselves to us. So it's really, from beginning to end, about a meditation practice. And within the practice, as we become more and more aware, we try to find words for our experience. But as Dido says, at this point, when we begin to really feel the connection, you could say, our tendency is to want to explain it, put it all down and lay it all out and make it all an intellectual idea. And as you can hear as I talk, it's not an intellectual idea. So it's a useless exercise in a way. And he reminds us that the best way is just to let go of all of it. The techniques, all the ways that we tweak our practice and push ourselves in a way, all the things that we think we know, that we just let them rise up and let them go again. That as we practice, we become more practiced in letting go of what shows up in our mind. The many, many, infinite, really, numbers of thoughts that show up in our mind. We don't have to be driven by them. And in zazen, we learn to acknowledge and to admit and to appreciate the working of our mind without being snagged by any of it, without being owned by it, without misunderstanding. We are where we always are, and we are who we always are. So at this stage, we're beyond words and beyond extra effort. Just the effort to stay put and be put is enough. And at that point, as we trust ourselves more, we begin to enter a kind of world of continuous practice. Dogen has a chapter in Shobo Genzo called Gyoji, which means continuous practice. And in it are stories, many, many stories of practicers in ancient times and how they practiced. How really dedicated they were in every different kind of life situation. Still, they gave themselves completely, wholeheartedly to practice itself. And that was his fundamental encouragement for us, was just to completely commit our to our life. Just as it is, the natural state of it. It means unselfconscious activity. And self-consciousness is often one of our great difficulties. As I've said before, I read not long ago that comparing ourselves to others is the last bastion of the ego, even though everything else is complete enlightenment. There's still this, how am I doing compared to so-and-so? Unselfconscious activity. Giving up that misunderstanding about self and other. Seeing through it. It's one of the great mysteries of us. So that's enough. We can have questions, discussion.
Looking at Thich Nhat Hanh's Our Appointment with Light. And what it is it's a treatment of the sutra on the better way of living alone.
Mm-hmm.
But better way of living alone has nothing to do with living alone.
Yes.
It has to do with living in the moment.
Yes.
Why is that?
Why is that?
How can that be?
Is that the one with the elephants on the cover?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, I love that. Well, in one sense, of course, we're totally alone. But if you look up the word alone in the dictionary, etymologically, it means all one. So that even if you go off into the desert, you can't get away from our life is not separate. We're alone, but we're not separate.
One time it was pointed out, and it's, I verified it, Suzuki Roshi's book, Zen Bang Beginner's Mind, he has the phrase in the book, the most important point is, maybe 15 times. And obviously that doesn't make any sense.
And it's a different point every time.
Yeah.
Yes.
Of a chapter, kind of a summary, as a summary thing. But nonetheless, there are, it's not just like one or two, like you made a mistake or you rephrased the same thing two ways. No, no, no. This is 15 completely separate points. And then you wonder, well, what about the 10,000 other words that are not preceded by the phrase, the most important point is? Or, you know, take what you've spoken about over the years, you know, which are the most important points, and there are many of them. So, but that's not so bad, because when someone says the most important point is, what they're suggesting to you is this might be something you might want to act on. And if you tried to, if you went to the flip side, which is kind of what I'm hearing in your interpretation of today's picture, is it's that picking and choosing and elevating this point is more important than all these other ones. Mm. Then, if you don't have bumps in the road, but everything's nice, and if you treat things without a filter, if you look at them more neutrally, they're just the things they are, which I understand. But it is so frequently useful to hear, you know, if you eat this way, then you'll live longer. That's convincing. It's like more veggies rather than more meat, today we know, may lead you to live not just a day longer, but 2 years longer. That's significant. So when a doctor comes along and says, these 10,000 studies over these 10, 20 years with these thousands of people has raised this important point, or when a Zen teacher says the most important point is, I tend to want to believe the doctors and the Zen teacher about that. Hmm. And yet, you're all, in some senses, saying you should just also be reasonable. The doctor said, you know, that's his way, I think, of saying the Zen lesson, well, it's all kind of neutral. You have to be reasonable about it. So, how do we inspire ourselves to act if we don't pull those things out that Suzuki Roshi chose or another teacher chooses to say are the most important? Isn't it inspiring to be told it's the most important?
Well, Well, you know, those were talks he gave that were then heavily edited so that he said, oh, I never said any of those things. He said somebody else made that book. So already, and Dogen, all of Dogen's work, almost all of it was transcribed by somebody. And who knows how much Ajo actually got down and how much it's from Ajo himself. Even with tapes and transcripts these days, a talk is given to a particular group. Buddha's talks were all given to a particular group. If you read Dogen, you see him contradict himself all over the place, because what's true in one context isn't true in another context. Or the way I think of it, that a teacher is not giving truths out, but saying, look, look, or look, or look. And so it depends on where we're already looking in the first place. And the teacher says, oh, but I know another way to look. Try this one. So that it all, you can't pin it down. Which is what this is about, actually, this chapter. Is about not trying to pin it down and make some kind of manufactured truth out of it. But to keep looking. And not, you know, as Buddha said, accept what resonates in you. Don't accept anything and believe anything unless it means something in your deepest heart. It isn't an intellectual belief system at all. So if you resonate about how you eat because you want to live longer, you know, that's real. And if someone, you know, in a parking lot says something that seems really profound and changes your life, that's Dharma.
Yeah, I think it would be foolish, and I've read Zen Mind and Goodness Mind many times.
Yeah.
I didn't mark the 15 points and only read that. I mean, you know, I've got, you know, there's so many other stories of him and many other people that are not the most important point is.
Yeah.
I acknowledge that, but I think that maybe someone else has been in their practice where I haven't yet, maybe, and that I can learn from their pointer to the moon is a little mm-hmm. closer to the moon than where I am right now. And they're helping me get there. But so I guess, can I turn it around and ask, so what do we do when we read or when we listen? Do we, I've heard, you know, some people say really interesting things about Dharma talks. Like you're supposed to, and I found this true in my own experience too, you come, you listen, and you go home, and you literally don't try to remember. You
yes.
just carry it with you.
Yes.
Which I think has happened to me on a few occasions when I've been more open. A lot of times I think I and other people, they come to a Dharma talk and they listen for a certain set of things that are okay with them. Right? And then, oh yeah, yeah, the teacher agreed with me on those points.
Yeah.
I'm home now, everything's okay. And that's so now.
Well, we chant the chant that we do for a reason. An unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Taste the truth. As you listen to a Dharma talk, the best way is to be in Zazen as you listen, rather than trying to figure out what it's all about. To listen from here and bring your questions up from here. And often people chant that same chant before they read a sutra. and they read the sutra in Zazen mind, because it comes in a completely different way. Thank you for your question. Julian?
From what he was saying, it seems sometimes at one point in time something rings true, and then in another point of time it's totally hogwash, or
yeah,
you know, like maybe like a movie that you really liked as a child, you look back on it and what the heck, you know, this is, you know, Barney, I mean. what was the question? It seems like what you were saying is that how do you know that what's resonating within your heart, I mean, if things continually change, how do you hang on to anything?
You don't? Zen mind, beginner's mind, is an interesting example. It's one, and sutras are like that too. And there are documents, you could say, that are true over and over again, but they're different every time you read them. That something new shines out of them each time. So that you can read something like Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind your whole life. Maybe. Some people do. Or the Lotus Sutra. Or Dogen's work. And even though you know it by heart, you can still get some completely new hit from it. Depending on where you are. Because our life keeps changing all the time, and so our needs and our understandings, our knowledge, everything changes. We can't hold any of it, but we can continue to be open to the next new insight that comes, and all of it informs us and inspires us.
And if I guess, like, that insight that we have at that time is what we mean need,
yes,
at that particular,
yes,
time, and just,
yes,
let it change and,
yes,
not be so worried about contradiction.
Yes. It's nourishment. It's nourishment. We feed ourselves that way.
Well, Scott, you might like Barney again.
I got rid of those tapes a long time ago.
Well, it's 8:00, so we'll go on next week. We have a study group.